This week, in Joshua chapters 3 through 5, Israel makes their long-awaited entry into the Promised Land and prepares for their siege of Jericho. To give this a little context, Israel has been staying on the east side of the Jordan, their Promised Land is on the west, and Jericho is directly across the river, standing in the way of their military campaign. In last week's message, we read of the spies who went to find any useful information about Jericho in preparation for the attack, and this week the army is on the move. We're going to be covering three chapters today, more than we usually discuss, but as I've mentioned before, this is all narrative, and narratives move along more quickly. In some cases, there isn't much that I can tell you that isn't already explicit in the passage. I'm sure I've got some valuable nuggets of information for you today, but we're going to cover a larger text to find them. In chapter 3, the Israelites will be crossing the Jordan River thanks to God miraculously drying up that river. In chapter 4, Israel will memorialize that crossing by pulling stones from the dry riverbed, and in chapter 5, they will spiritually prepare themselves for the attack by circumcising their men and celebrating the Passover. And in the end of that chapter, Joshua will have a meeting with a mysterious visitor, but we won't be discussing that today. We'll save verses 13 and 15 for next week. Your recommended reading, then, is Joshua chapter 3, verse 1, through chapter 5, verse 12. And if you haven't read those yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. In the opening of chapter 3, Israel sets out to cross the Jordan. Joshua calls the people forth early in the morning, and they make their trek to the river where they set up camp. After waiting for 3 days, Joshua's commanders give the army their marching orders. Follow the Ark of the Covenant, a holy relic which contained God's laws and represented his presence, but do so at a distance of 2,000 cubits, about 3,000 feet or 914 meters. To give you an idea of how far that is, it's about the length of 9 football fields. So they were staying way back. It seems to me that it would be difficult to even see the Ark from that distance. My supposition is that the miraculous pillar of cloud, which commonly led Israel in their wanderings, might also have been with the Ark guiding them. But if it was, the passage doesn't mention it. Regardless, the Ark was leading the way, and the people were ordered to stay back so that they would not overtake it or stray from it, since they did not know the area. In verse 5, Joshua told the people to consecrate themselves, that is, essentially, to keep themselves clean and put on their best behavior, because Jehovah would be performing miracles among them the next day. Thereafter, he ordered the priests to march with the Ark, and they did so. Now, the Jordan River presented a formidable obstacle. At an ordinary flow, this section of the Jordan is as much as 100 feet wide and 10 feet deep, and it is a turbulent river. So to get across without a bridge or boats or rafts or some such, everyone in the army would have to swim across for 100 feet, and they would have to do so carrying their weapons and supplies and wearing armor. Needless to say, that would have been very difficult, if not impossible. And I have linked for you in the library a source which claims that even an expert swimmer would have difficulty crossing the Jordan. But matters were even more daunting than that, because, we read in verse 15, the Jordan was overflowing, as was common in harvest season. So make no mistake, a miracle was needed for Joshua and his men to get to the Battle of Jericho. Thankfully, Jehovah, that is, the Lord in all caps, as many of you likely see God's name translated in your English versions of the Bible, has a miraculous solution. And the miracle will be performed not only to get the people where they need to go, but to solidify their faith in Joshua, that God was with him as he was with Moses. Joshua was ordered by God to command the priests to stand still in the Jordan River, and so Joshua passed word on that God had ordered this. He further assured them that God would be faithful in driving out the peoples of Canaan, and he explained what would happen, that when the priests obeyed the instruction, the waters on the north side would stop flowing and would pile up as in a heap, and that everywhere south of the heap, the bed of the Jordan would be dry. Despite the incredible nature of the claim, the people faithfully followed their orders and the miracle happened just as had been promised. And that is quite an amazing claim. This is a river with a massive flow of water, and we aren't just talking about moving a little water out of the way. The river was still flowing, and everything flowing into a heap was going to get stuck there. So don't picture just a little blob of water standing up while they walk across in a single file line. This must have looked more like a small mountain of water. And the water stopped flowing far upstream, near a town called Adam, about 10 to 15 miles north. And as the water flowed down, those waters left behind dry ground all the way to the Dead Sea, here called the Araba or Salt Sea. So this was a massive dry space for a large group of people to cross, and it left a mountain of water north of them. And so, with a mountain of water on one side, the river ran dry before them, and the people of Israel crossed on dry ground with the priests holding the ark in the middle. And we note, for anyone who may not have made the connection, that this miracle bears a striking resemblance to the miracle which Moses performed at the Sea of Reeds, probably called the Red Sea in your English translation, when Israel crossed that on dry ground. And thus, we move on to chapter 4. In that chapter, God gave Joshua an instruction which Joshua faithfully relayed to the people and which the people obeyed. It was an instruction to create a memorial. 12 men were chosen, one from each tribe, and they were tasked with taking 12 stones out of the dry riverbed to be used in building the memorial. And my supposition is that they chose 12 strong men and that those 12 strong men worked together to bring up 12 large stones. And this, I think, was quite clever, because this arrangement of 12 stones would be not only a memorial of the event, but an evidence proving it had occurred. There is a visible distinction between a river stone and a ground stone. The ground stone has a rough texture, but the river stone is smoothed over by many years of continual friction of the water. So in generations to come, the descendants of these Israelites would be able to come to the place and see the smooth stones. Well, where could those stones have come from? No place but the river. And how could anyone have gotten the stones out? The water is deep. The water is moving. The stones are dense and heavy. There is no scuba equipment. There is no heavy construction machinery. The only way that those smooth stones could have gotten out of the river and onto the ground is if something had stopped the water. The miracle is the most obvious, and really is the only obvious solution to the problem. After the conquest, God's presence would not be so direct as it had been in Joshua's day. The children of Israel might never see these kinds of mighty miracles for themselves, but they would not pass this tradition down only because they had heard it from their fathers. They would pass it down because they could see the evidence for themselves. But of course, the fact that their descendants would be able to see and deduce this would not change the fact that the fathers must teach it to them. And the fathers were explicitly told to explain to their children what had happened. Verses 21 through 24 are very explicit about this. The fathers were to explain the meaning of the stones, that God had dried up the river to let the people cross. And specifically, God did this so that his people would know his might and fear him forever. And indeed, it is still the duty of fathers everywhere to explain such truths to their children so that God's glory would be known from generation to generation. And so I hope that you will do such in your own life. Now there is some question brought about by verse 9 about whether there might have been two memorials. The verse from the ESV says this, "And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood." Reading that, we get the impression that there may have been two stone memorials, one where the soldiers made camp, and the other in the river. And such is possible. Perhaps 12 stones were removed from the river and deposited on the west side, while 12 other stones were moved back into the river from the ground. Supposing that those stones were particularly tall, they might have showed above the top of the water. Or, since they would have been placed where the priest stood, at the very eastern edge of the river, the stones might have been visible, regardless of their size. Perhaps the memorial was intended to show when the river was low, and to be covered when it was high, as a sort of demonstration of what had happened there. And perhaps those stones, having come from the land, would be recognizable as rough ground stones, so that those who came could clearly see. The dry ground had been brought to the riverbed, and the riverbed had been brought to the dry ground. I would suggest, though, on the grounds that there is little description of this second memorial, compared to much description of the first one, that there is maybe some misunderstanding in translation, and that there was no second memorial at all. We would need to change only three words in the verse, turning in to from twice, and set up to raised up, to have the following translation. "And Joshua raised up 12 stones from the midst of the Jordan, from the place where the feet of the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant had stood." In that translation, we understand this to be not a creation of a second otherwise undescribed memorial, but a further description of the creation of the already mentioned memorial. And I can see no reason why we should not accept such a translation. The verb rendered set up just as easily means raised up, and the preposition for in likewise has a broad range of meaning, and prepositions tend to be the least stable sort of words. So in my mind, this verse ought to take the translation which best matches its context, that there was no second memorial, but the stones were simply described as being taken up from there to build the first memorial. And so the people crossed over the Jordan in a hurry. The 2.5 tribes, fulfilling their duties as discussed in our opening message on the book of Joshua, passed on at the front of them with 40,000 men ready for war. And when the people had crossed over, Joshua summoned the priests, as Jehovah commanded, and the priests carrying the ark came up out of the river and went back to leading the people. When they did so, the water flowed back in behind them. And thus the people saw a great miracle and were amazed at Joshua, just as they had previously been with Moses. And we note also, looking back to verse 9, that the memorial created by Joshua and his men was listed as being there, quote, to this day, end quote. This day being, of course, not the modern day, but the day that the text was written. Of course, the memorial is not still there, and so the text was written at some point much closer to Joshua's lifetime. And in fact, as I have stated previously, the book was written in Joshua's own lifetime, per its own claims. And in verse 19, we see another mark of historicity. The verse tells us that this happened on the 10th day of the first month. Now, obviously, a forger could pick a precise date. Of course, a good forger would not do so if his account could possibly be verified, because picking an exact date would be much more likely to prove his account false than it would be to prove it true. And the simple claim by the author that he knows the exact date suggests that he has very specific and accurate information. We don't find exact dates in fairy tales. We find exact dates in history books. Of course, there are some who will scoff and deny the reality of this event. It has been long enough that Israel was displaced and their memorial evidently was destroyed. But in my mind, it still doesn't make sense to deny that this happened. We know, not only from the Bible but from Egyptian records, that the Hebrews were slaves in Egypt. We know that they somehow got from there to Canaan. We know that escaping slaves couldn't have attacked Canaan at the heavily fortified border with Egypt. So if they didn't get into Canaan this way, across the river, then just how did they get there? This is the only best path. And they didn't leave behind any contrary historical account saying that they did something else. The only record we have is this one, which endures and which everyone believed, that they crossed the river on dry ground. And if there is a God, as we know that there is, then why not? The only reason to deny this account is a presupposition against God's existence. If a person decides that there can't be a God, then he believes that the miracle is impossible, and then he goes out looking for another solution where there isn't one. But there's no sense in that. There is a God. He could do this. This story makes the most sense, and all accounts point to this being the truth. And the people who told the story, knowing that we might question them, were certain to record the precise date and to leave behind a memorial to prove the fact so that we would believe them. Well, 3,500 years later, the memorial is gone, but that doesn't change the fact. These people walked over the river, and just because it happened a long time ago doesn't mean it didn't happen. And it certainly doesn't mean that we can look back and know their experiences better than they did. And thus, we move on to chapter 5. From verse 1, evidently someone had posted watchmen near to the river, because news of what had happened there spread quickly, such that the kings of the pagan peoples living in the land of Canaan west of the Jordan heard of the event and were very much afraid. And my supposition is that the invading Israelites heard as much in the reports of the other spies and from any captured combatants. But though they had crossed the river, the Israelites were not yet ready for their attack. First, God required them to tend to some religious duties. Primary among those was circumcision. If you want more information on circumcision and its context throughout the Bible, I recommend that you listen to our message, Circumcision, published July 24, 2016. But for the short version, circumcision was the mark that a man was a member of God's people, and that mark was the cutting away of his foreskin. This is one of those distinctly Old Testament ceremonial practices which is no longer valid for modern Christians. Now, the passage explains that the men of this generation which crossed the Jordan had not been circumcised. We don't have a clear explanation as to why. Evidently, their fathers had been circumcised in Egypt, but had neglected to maintain the practice on their own sons in the wilderness. Whether this was done from some necessity of wilderness living or from simple failure to adhere to the law is uncertain, but regardless, the circumcision had to be done. If God was going to lead these people, they needed to be very distinctly his people. And this was the mark of distinction. So Joshua's orders from Jehovah were these: make flint knives, or perhaps better translated sharp knives, and use them to circumcise the men a second time. And we suppose that in saying a second time, God didn't mean that any who had already been circumcised ought to be circumcised again, but that circumcision itself, which had not been practiced in some time, ought to be practiced again. So this is the second round of circumcision coming back into fashion. And I must say, it was an act of great faith to circumcise all these men. In the first place, I'd say that it certainly demonstrates great faith for any man to be willing to cut off a piece of such a valuable part of his equipment, and the pain of doing so would surely dissuade any unfaithful person. In the second place, the army would need time to heal from their wounds, and they had just crossed the line of the river and thus exposed themselves to the enemy, no pun intended. If they had done this on the east side of the Jordan, it might have been one thing, but being on the other side is another entirely. They've basically walked onto the battlefield, and immediately after doing so, they've incapacitated their entire fighting force. So truly, they are confident of their ability to conquer with God's help, and their enemies, who fail to attack in this moment of weakness, are obviously very much afraid. As for the name of the place, there are apparently two. Verse 3 lists Gibeath Ha'araloth, meaning, most unpleasantly, Hill of Foreskins. That is either an alternate name, or perhaps the name of a very specific hill in a place more commonly called Gilgal. Gilgal we shall see throughout the scriptures, but we'll never read this name, Gibeath Ha'araloth, again. It bears noting that Gilgal had a name before Israel got there. Moses had called the place Gilgal in Deuteronomy 11:30, so the name was not invented on the day in question. However, verse 9 tells us that the Israelites continued to use that name because of what God said in response to their act of faith and circumcision. Gilgal means to roll, and so God made a little pun. Today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. By marking themselves, these people were no longer to be associated with Egypt from which their fathers had come. Today they were truly distinct, and were in their own land. Today they were Israelites. And as though stopping to cut themselves wasn't enough religious ritual, they also stopped for Passover. Passover is a holiday feast, which we discussed back on October 1st, 2017, which commemorates the Exodus from Egypt. It was to be celebrated on the 14th day of the first month in the spring, and the fact that this military invasion landed at the same time was no excuse for skipping it. And so the people celebrated the feast. So this is the weirdest military advance you've ever heard of. The army crossed into enemy territory, stopped to injure everyone on their team, took a break for a few days, and then threw a feast. They hadn't even attacked anyone yet, that we know of. When they had finished the feast, on the next day they ate the food of the land. Perhaps they ate from plants which had grown wild, or perhaps they raided the stores of fields from the Canaanites who had fled to the cities for protection from the invading army. But either way, they ate food which had grown from the land. And with that, we have an important event. The manna stopped. Now, if you are unfamiliar with manna, you might look back to our message Manna and Quail, published November 5th, 2017. There we learned that manna was a miraculous food which God provided for Israel's sustenance while they were wandering the wilderness. Well, they aren't wandering the wilderness anymore. They're in the Promised Land, and they've got the food of the land, and in some degree, God is stepping back from his role as divine nanny. The bread falling from heaven is over. These people are going to have to start getting their own food, and while they'll always have God for support, he won't be doing everything for them anymore. At least, not so directly and obviously. So then in conclusion, the army of Israel has finally entered the Promised Land, and they've done so in grand fashion, demonstrating tremendous faith in the process. God led them to the edge of the Jordan, and they faithfully stepped in to witness a spectacular miracle. They memorialized this on the edge of the Jordan River with a monument made of river stones, a monument which would both remind coming generations of God's greatness and also demonstrate that greatness. And having crossed the river, they were obedient in honoring the religious rituals which God required of them, even when those rituals presented great pain and risk. This generation is not stiff-necked, as their fathers were. They are ready to take the land of Canaan. Next week, the conquest begins with the famous siege of Jericho. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.